All right.
I have a real thrill, don't worry.
Yeah. Oh, really?
So I'm Steve Sandiford with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is September the 21st. The time is approximately
4:15.
That clock's not correct.
Okay.
It keeps time like a bar clock.
Yeah. I'm accompanied by various members of the FCIC. We're at the offices of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve for an interview with Tom Boyamio. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Boyamio. Could I get your verbal assent on the record?
Well, wait a minute. Does he have to consent to it? I thought you all were doing it just as a matter of course.
I don't know.
Can you?
Okay. I'd like to decline it.
Yeah, I know. But, yeah. But I'm not an attorney.
I mean, you can decline on the. Well, all right, let's talk about it. Would you like to decline?
So skip the question and
why,
just let's
why
go.
Why are you recording it?
Because we're creating an oral history of all of the interviews, and that,
okay. All right.
That's why we're doing it.
That's not a good reason, but all right.
Okay, so we'll just go around. Everybody state your full name and affiliation for the record and spell your last name to be clear. I'll start. I'm Steve Sandiford. I'm with the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond on loan to the FCIC.
I'm Alexis Sevendinger with the FCIC writing team.
Tom Boyamio from the Federal Reserve, Boemio.
Dave Caperton, Caperton, Federal Reserve Board.
Randall Dodd, DODD, research team at the FCIC.
And so real quickly, in the way of background, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, FCIC, was established by statute and signed into law.
So I explained it to him, but we're kind of on limited time. I would suggest we get to the questions.
Okay. Tom, if you have questions about FCIC, we can go. But I do think this is an important part of the history. Folks are experts, on these complex capital matters. So,
thank you for doing that.
Yeah,
we've had no choice, right?
We've discussed with other regulators and. Kind of what I've been doing is focusing on kind of a history of capital regulation, and there's some standouts in terms of areas that a lot of people agree. There's a lot of finger pointing too. So, with your expertise, want to go through some of these and your perspective on the ground broadly. Regulation, our guidance around asset-backed commercial paper conduits. Sort of the development of all things in that realm, sort of securitization development, and 2001 stands out as a particular milestone. The increasing role of holding companies in securitizing product and innovation there, and the 1996 market risk amendments are kind of key highlights. Including the application of the MRA to derivative transactions in like 97. Mm-hmm. And we can flavor in here some discussion of like Bistro and some of the other key things. But Tom, I don't know, maybe start with asset-backed conduit structures.
What's your question?
Well, yeah, I'm quite.
Yeah. Kind of the development in there since like we had some guidance in 1993 which talked about the structure of these programs by 2003-2004 we had there were some guidance along the way, but another kind of milestone when the FIN 46R came about. We made a change in the capital charge at that point.
Which one do you want to talk about? You got 2000. You got the 2001 recourse rule. You got the
purely along an ABCP. kind of take different pieces and talk about it, unless you want to do it.
That's fine. But the thing is you need to look at the capital rules for securitization as a continuum going all the way back to the 80s. And I'm a little concerned you're going to take everything out of context. With respect to 2004 FIN 46. FIN 46 was going to consolidate variable interest entities, which you already know. The banking agencies, and FIN 46 did not look at the risk of the transactions. They did not look at who held the risk. It was mainly a control standard, similar to what's going on now with 166 and 167. The banking agencies, in its rulemaking of 2004/2005, essentially said we're going to look at the risk and hold capital against the risk. And this is when we started assessing capital against short-term liquidity facilities extended to asset-backed commercial paper programs.
And that capital charge specifically was increased?
Well, the short-term commitments from the 1988 Accord were zero.
That's right.
And 2004, in that rulemaking, it was increased to, it was 10%, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
And that's about, I'm going to 180 basis points?
Yeah.
So, and in long-term commitments, as you know, were 4% gap.
Yes. So that specifically, two questions. The development of the market has grown pretty dramatically, maybe not as dramatically as in the next 5 years, but dramatically over time. And we're looking at the risk of the transaction. What was your view of the shift from, say, 1993 to 2004 in the ABCP programs?
Well, they started in 83. So the shift was, well, there were more competitors. They started looking at asset types other than trade receivables, which was the primary asset at the time. So, they started looking at credit cards, autos, mortgages. You know this. You've examined all these guys.
You're the expert. So there was a shift in that composition. Can you talk specifically about, I mean, there was language about, but your experience, what constituted a credit backstop versus a liquidity backstop and the thinking at the time?
Well, the guarantee on the program-wide credit enhancement is an irrevocable guarantee if certain credit events were triggered. Liquidity facilities can be either commitment to lend or commitment to purchase assets. The liquidity facility is protected by the over-collateralization provided by the sellers of the assets to the conduit, right? So therefore, it's not a direct guarantee. It'd be more of a second-tier guarantee or secondary loss position. The liquidity facility has outs, or clauses that will let it escape funding if, losses exceed a certain point.
Yes.
And the amount of liquidity facility that would be available to the conduit would decline as losses go up. So in other words, they couldn't fund against bad assets and that sort of thing. So that's why it's not a guarantee in the same sense as an irrevocable guarantee at the program-wide level is.
Others have sort of made the statements that,
Hey, Steve, I forgot to say in the beginning that this is covered by our confidentiality agreement. If any confidential information that gets revealed or communicated here is covered by that agreement. So I forgot to say that. Sorry.
Yep. Everything's confidential. I don't even talk to myself.
Good, keep it.
Yeah, good.
Not a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I do, but not about this stuff. That's a good. So, others that we've talked to, when some of these assets were brought back on book, like you say, you can choose to...
When?
SIVs? In the financial crisis.
All right, so you've got the SIVs are different from the multi-sellers, are different from the credit arbitrage, are different from single sellers.
Exactly.
So SIVs came back on book. The reason the SIVs came back on book is because they have less than 100% liquidity backstop. Because, as you know, liquidity is expensive. So the SIVs were an attempt to use the liquidity of the assets held in the conduit to provide liquidity to the conduit, because they had market value triggers.
That's right.
Right? So part of the crisis was a panic and a fire sale.
Did they have less than 100% liquidity because they had intermediate term notes out and some subordinate debt, and so not all of the SIV was financed by short-term paper?
No, they had liquidity. They didn't have 100% liquidity because they had what they perceived to be liquid assets in the conduit that they would sell when they needed. And as it turned out, when the crisis hit, because the declines in market value, then they couldn't sell it for the price that they needed to sell it for. And then, because people, you know, it was not just one SIV, but two SIVs, it was three SIVs, it was sort of a cascading effect.
Yep.
And as a result, they couldn't sell at all, except for ludicrous prices that resulted as a result of the fire sale.
Right. With some of the multi-seller programs, others have said that, in their experience, that the liquidity puts weren't really exercised. The institution chose to either repurchase assets or bring the commercial paper back on books. And in fact, those performed relatively well.
Well, you know, I can only give you just the experience from a distance, because I was in Basel from 2007, 2000, just recently.
For the crisis.
So I can only give you what I saw from afar, but from what I understood is that they could have drew the liquidity.
Right.
But instead they issued the commercial paper and then they purchased it and held on to it. Not all of it, but a portion of it as a result to provide liquidity to the conduit. So the risk is effectively the same. You know, they have the commercial paper and they hold it on their balance sheet, or they hold the risk vis-a-vis the liquidity facility with the credit enhancement in front of it from the sellers.
Right.
Right. So
wait, it was their own liquidity on this, their sponsoring institution?
Yeah, but they're at risk vis-a-vis the underlying assets, right?
Ultimately.
Yeah, so they hold the commercial paper. The liquidity that they provided to the conduit in order to get the commercial paper rated, you know, that's not really an issue. They're still at risk vis-a-vis the underlying assets in the conduit, one way or the other. But they could have provided liquidity through the liquidity facilities, or they could issue the paper, which they did, and then they could hold it and then sell it. I understand most of them were selling within a week or so.
Right.
So, if if they exercise the liquidity facility, you know, that's a longer term.
That's right.
And so this is going to make the market work in a more efficient manner, as opposed to just pulling everything out of the conduit. So, you know.
Let me make sure I understood you correctly describing how these SIVs were kind of rescued.
I didn't say anything about them being rescued. I said
right.
that said that they didn't have 100% liquidity, which is why they ran into some issues. Now, go ahead.
A different word, whatever word you want to use. Whatever you want to describe the activity of banks extending them that credit outside their credit contract. They were voluntarily buying their commercial. That's what I didn't say. The bank was buying the...
That's not the SIVs. That was the multi-sellers.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is with respect to the multi-sellers, all banks, investment banks, they can buy their own asset. They can make a market in the notes that they issue, and they do. They have for 100 years, however long. And they can buy back from investors that they've sold it to initially. They can hold it, and they can resell it. So it's making a market. So the way it could be looked at is if they were making a market in a portion of the commercial paper that was issued by the conduit, and then they resold it onto the market when there was appetite on the investor's part to buy it. So if they issued $100 worth of CP, right, then maybe they couldn't sell the whole 100. Maybe
right.
They could only sell 90. So they took 90 in, they held it, and then within a week, and this is my understanding, they sold it off into the market.
So in regards to the multi-seller structures, SMA commercial paper programs, the sponsoring banks were buying back the commercial paper when the rest of the market seemed to be absent.
When it was issued, they would buy a portion of it. They weren't buying it back. So it was issued. They take 10%. That's an example. They sell 90, and then within a week they sell the other 10%. So it's not like it was sold into the market, and then they were buying it back in order to support the investors. That's a different thing.
They were buying it at the point of
issuance
by the seller conduit, and so just they were inventorying it until the market conditions improved.
Effectively warehousing,
and that was much cheaper and fluid than having their line of credit exercise.
The liquidity facility.
If they could have
drawn on the liquidity facility. But if you draw on a liquidity facility, where you take back some of the paper, or you purchase some of the paper at issuance, you're providing liquidity to the conduit. And the question is how do you want to do it? You can be efficient, or you can be inefficient. Also, it also gives signals to the market, too, as far as the volume of paper that's issued.
If this liquidity facility was exercised, then it was a collateral, it was sort of secured liquidity facility, and that's why the assets would go back to the bank.
Well, what the bank gets is a senior beneficial interest in the asset pool that the conduit holds. In other words, there's two. Do you want to go through the whole two-step process of the accounting? But when the seller sells assets to the conduit, there's usually a two-step process because the accounting requires us to ensure true sales. So the seller of receivables will sell to an SPE. The SPE will then sell on to the conduit senior beneficial interest in the asset pool held in the SPE, and basically the subordinated piece is held by the seller. That is the credit protection provided to the bank as the liquidity provider. So if the liquidity provider, the bank who's the liquidity provider, provides liquidity to the conduit, what he gets is that senior beneficial interest. Okay.
That was previously retained by the SPE.
Well, it's the asset of the SPE, yes.
But the liquidity put provider has primary rights to this case.
The liquidity provider has that asset. He has the rights to the senior beneficial interest in the pool. So it's just like securitization with a securitization.
Yep.
He is at the top of the waterfall, so he'll get paid first, and then anything that's left over will go to pay the residual that the seller of the assets originally had, and he could lose money.
I hit a simple term, but you know, there's a perception. You know, these programs are off balance sheet until 166, 167, and then some of them come back on the balance sheet because of the support that was required. I think that's public and all, but there's a perception. Is this implicit recourse, this the providing, the holding of the commercial paper, in your opinion?
No.
And the reason?
Hey, it was done up front. It was done for liquidity purposes. What was done during the crisis, I viewed it as being done for liquidity purposes because they had that exposure already. So they could have exercised it through the liquidity facility. In the middle of a crisis, my view is, do you want them to make it worse, or do you want them to make it better? And by holding the commercial paper, in my view, help facilitate the activities of that market, because they're still financing real companies and real economic activity. And that's part of the point of a bank and part of the point of these conduits, as you know, to fund it.
Yes. As you're making that assessment, are you also concerned about the multi-seller conduits that have also invested beyond just the traditional bank customer into RMBS and ABS in their structures?
That's not necessarily extending it beyond normal bank customers. I mean, you look at typically they would warehouse assets, mortgages, autos, credit cards, until such time that the primary institution wanted to put it into a term deal and then sell it out. A lot of times it was ensuring that they were able to generate enough volume to put out the term deal. Sometimes they were waiting for the rates or market conditions to change to improve so that they can then issue it to the market. It's not like they were holding mortgages in their conduit for 30 years, funding it with short-term commercial paper for 30 years.
Right.
One piece.
That's what I wanted to clarify. So, even in these single seller instances, what we read about, those were all intended as a temporary sale.
Single sellers, they're going to sometimes they'll put it in conduit. Single sellers is much more of a direct connection. I mean, they're financing their own activity. So you might have somebody putting their credit cards and financing their credit cards in a conduit. That's typically what I haven't really seen too much of anything else. I've seen the credit cards, and I can't speak to everything. Credit cards, as you know, are short-term self-liquidating receivables. You know, sometimes they would put them in there to access the short-term rates of the market as opposed to the longer-term rates. So it's one way to, again, try to be more efficient with respect to their funding.
From the, you know, CIVs, sponsored ABCP programs, multi-seller, single-seller, institutions were also, you know, on the other side, the development of these liquidity puts, which caused a lot of problems in various situations.
You keep mentioning liquidity puts. Are you talking about what exactly? As opposed to liquidity facilities. So you're talking more in derivative terms.
Yes.
What are you getting at?
Yep. I can talk in specific terms, right?
Well, if you just use letter of credit or liquidity facility, that's a little bit more specific, and I think that's kind of what you want to get at, right?
Well, liquidity put is a specific term.
Yes.
And if you talk about liquidity facilities, that's a different term. Liquidity facility is something that is not derivative form.
That's right. Yeah. So we're talking about the derivatives now.
Okay.
Yep.
So what do you want to know?
Everything.
What instruments use something you would specifically call liquidity put?
CDOs.
We have a liquidity put associated with that.
They'll have commercial paper at the top of the CDO, and they'll revolve it out at the top, and they'll have a liquidity put and treat it as a derivative, which is why in 2004, 2005, whenever I did that rulemaking,
yes,
that we carved out liquidity puts in the trading book out of the covered positions and said you're going to hold capital against them as you would any other liquidity facility, so that we would ensure that there was no arbitrage and create an incentive to put liquidity facilities for asset-backed commercial paper in totality into the trading book.
Right. And that was a specific carve-out.
Yeah.
How accurately do you think the banks reflected that in their risk-based capital?
That I can't answer. You would be in a better position. You were an examiner. You'd be in a better position to tell me.
I'm not sure which reference and what I can talk about. I mean, there were specific examples where the banks came clean and said, we don't have these liquidity puts in any facility.
Well, again, remember, I was not around 2007 to 2010, so I was not privy to a lot of information.
Yeah.
Because I was not...
Yeah.
I couldn't talk to the banks. I really didn't get much at all.
That's right. But your statement about in 2004 putting this as a separate carve out of the trading,
and at that point the banks knew damn well what they were.
Yep.
Because we talked about it again, liquidity, asset-backed commercial paper, the issuance of asset-backed commercial paper in support of, I can't remember the exact language, but essentially it was liquidity facilities or liquidity put options, whatever you want to call it, directly or indirectly providing liquidity to asset-backed commercial paper programs or whatever, versus asset-backed commercial paper. However it was put, it was done, it was broad enough to capture any kind of provision of liquidity, regardless of the name, to these sorts of, to that sort of liability. So yes, they do.
Yep. But we found out after the fact that...
Well, that's another issue.
...that we're missing. Can I ask you, again, your perspective, And we're talking to the other people, so you can just say this isn't in my bailiwick or whatever. What were, say, examiner skills in relation to assessing, say, liquidity puts? Should we ask somebody else?
Yeah, I mean, I was not, as you know, I'm not in the field, so, you know.
But we call you, Tom.
You do call me.
Yeah. So, can we talk then let's talk about other credit derivatives. And in 96, you didn't write this letter, I don't think, but in 96, we set up a framework for credit guarantees. And it essentially was one of a counterparty because you had, I've got exact. This
what SL letter is it?
Pardon?
What SL letter is
it? Yeah, it was, I've got it in here. SR 9617.
I did write this.
It sounded like you.
It's
So in this letter,
we set up. I know what that is.
Yeah, we set up, but essentially it becomes the Otto Gors rating because you've got a third party. In 97, but you know, in this letter, we talk about the coming market risk amendment. And in 97, we write another one that says, here's how to deal with this under the market risk.
Basically, if it's in the trading book and the subject to the market risk rule, then they treat it as a derivative. That's the time we went to the market risk rule. And so if you're in, if you had things held in the trading book, and a credit derivative is a derivative, you know, it can be analogized to a standby letter of credit, but it's similar in function to an interest rate swap. Trying to strip off interest rates, interest risk, interest rate risk, or credit risk. So, you know, you come up with the market risk rule subject to the trading, you know, if you have this market risk rule subject to things held in the trading book.
Except for liquidity puts.
That was later on in 2004.
That's 2004. That's a good point. Based on the developments in the market. We've had conflicting discussion from experts on how an asset might be treated in the trading book. One, can I ask specifically about a credit derivative, just a broad overview of the framework, how it would be treated in the trading book?
First of all, I'm going to say I'm not a market risk.
That's fair.
Person. I don't really know the rule too much.
Well, I mean, let's...
I'm interested in capital.
But even from capital perspective, I don't know the market risk rule. I mean, the thing is you've got the capability to model certain things if you've been approved.
That's right.
By the Reserve Bank and by the board. I think today there's only a handful of banks that have that approval, if I remember. I don't know how much it may have changed since I went to Basel. There's a standardized approach that I don't know too much about.
Yes.
But I think the standardized approach is going to have higher capital charges than what may happen under modeling when they're able to have offset long and short positions. All that sort
of stuff. There are other folks lined up for interviews, so make sure you stick to the stuff you know.
Yeah, so I can't get into the specifics about how it works.
That's fair. Can we talk about the trading book treatment of other assets, like mortgages and, you know, 2007, Susan Baez has a statement that, gosh, there's all sort of stuff in this trading book. It's not just daily traded assets. Is that a fair question to ask about how that would be treated?
I can't tell you how it would actually be treated. I can tell you that there are things in the trading book that are not traded on a daily basis.
That's right.
There are things held in the trading book that are marked to model.
Yep. What about the transfer, the arbitrage opportunity between the banking book and the trading book?
Well, clearly, the capital charge, I can say the capital charge in the trading book, if modeled, tends to be lower than if it's held in the trading book. The capital charge would tend to be lower than the capital charge against the asset if it's held in the banking book.
Yes.
Yes, I did say that right.
But
you were looking at me, and I'm like, oh, I think I said that right.
My hearing. So lower in the trading book.
If it's particularly if it's modeled, it's probably going to be lower. All in. I mean, you know, you can have some people make the argument on a standalone basis. There are certain things that will have higher capital charges, but when you model it all in and net everything down, then it's going to be generally lower.
And this may be a point for the market risk folks,
mm-hmm.
But a specific risk that's modeled in. That's fair.
I don't deal with that too much.
Okay.
Because I go to the market risk folks.
Okay. Well, that's you know, something like those meetings. Now we're kind of talk about securitization and rating agencies. I mean, to an extent, we've, you know, since the structure of asset-backed commercial paper, I mean, you have the rating agencies involved.
Mm-hmm.
Explicitly in 2001, that was brought in. But I wanted to talk about, get some historical context. I mean, this is kind of part of it. Like in 1997,
mm-hmm.
JPM is a big part of this as well, the Bistro deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that largely, I I think there was some 1999 guidance around collateralized loan obligations that was
99-32.
Yeah, that was specifically. It didn't say bistro.
No, it did not.
Okay. Your view, looking back, I mean, it worked out pretty good. I mean, that deal's gone. But it was a specific, okay, regulators, we want capital arbitrage. You know, and the bistro deal specifically was commercial loans. And we're going to accomplish this with the involvement of the rating agencies. In that particular deal, I believe there was a credit default swap from a OECD counterparty bank. So that allowed for a 20% risk weighting, kind of similar to the 96 letter on credit derivatives that you kind of got a counterparty bank in there. But then those arbitrage is morphed.
Well, actually, I think the term of arbitrage is inappropriate because the idea was to actually align capital with the risk in the various tranches, to make risk commensurate, to make capital commensurate with the risk. So, you know, regulatory arbitrage used by many people is it's a dirty word. It's
right.
A negative connotation.
Right.
And the idea behind using ratings from the 2001 capital rules was to align capital with the risk. And the idea with respect to the bistro transaction, which was using credit derivative technology to effectively create tranches of credit risk that can be sold or retained.
Yes.
Was to, again, the idea behind the SR letter in 99 was to assess capital against the various pieces that the bank retained that in a manner that we thought was appropriate given the risk that they retained. For instance, the first loss piece was deducted, right? Or hold capital dollar for dollar.
I'm not sure on the bistro at the time.
Yes,
the
it was.
Deal. Was it?
Yes.
That's.
And if I recall, the first loss piece that particular thing couldn't be any more than the expected loss on the pool. It had to be deducted. The mezzanine pieces, which constituted about 7% of the deal, were then rated, sold into the market.
That's right.
The capital rules had nothing to do with the rating at that time.
Yes.
Right? Because then what was is that the collateral that was taken through the sale of the notes, and basically the cash that they received for the notes, they bought treasuries or something else, and then they capital treatment would be based on that in accordance with the 88 rule.
Right.
So if they held treasuries, then it would be collateralized by treasuries. If they held Ginny Mae's or Fannie Mae's, Freddie Mac, then it would be collateralized by the GSEs.
And the swap from the OECD bank, and so we're overlaid the whole structure?
Well, there was, and I can't remember everything because I haven't read
it
in about 10 or 11 years.
Yep.
If you had a guarantee or credit default swap from an OECD bank as a guarantee, then you get a 20% risk weight. That's in line with the 88 Accord as well.
Right. Following the 96 sort of credit derivative framework.
96 framework had nothing to do with
not
calling a credit derivative guarantee.
Right.
Credit derivative is a guarantee. And so if I'm a bank and I give you a credit derivative, I'm going to hold capital as if I give you a letter of credit, right?
That's right.
So the flip side is also true. If I'm an OECD bank giving you a letter of credit, you get a 20% risk weight on the asset that's protected. So if I give you a credit derivative, if I write you a credit default swap and I'm an OECD bank, then capital charge would be equivalent.
That's right. That's what I remember from the bistro deal. As regulators continue to approve those types of arrangements?
From time to time. I mean, there's been a lot of things that have been said over the years, and so people pretty much know what's going on. I mean, you always have people coming in with new thoughts.
Do you think in this area regulators were pushed too far in terms of capital alignment? Did it go to the level of arbitrage?
Pushed by whom?
By the industry. By the big banks?
Actually, I would argue no. I think that Basel II, particularly in our recourse rule, I think we did a lot to align capital with risk. I think Basel II aligns the capital more closely with the risk of the assets while they're on balance sheets, so that minimizes the need to securitize for arbitrage purposes. People get all caught up, and you read it in the paper today, it's sort of like folks that talk about securitization is being used for arbitrage, capital arbitrage. You usually don't know much about securitization.
Yeah.
Securitization in the beginning, when it was started really, it was started by the GSEs.
That's right.
To create liquidity in the secondary market on a nationwide basis. When banks got involved in 86, mid-80s, 86 was the first credit card deal I remember from an institution, and they did it for funding. Now, there were capital implications. So clearly, capital can be a constraint, and it can be a benefit. If you are able to securitize, you can get a capital benefit, but then you've got to ask, well, what's the primary reason for doing it? Are you doing it to fund yourself in a cheaper manner? Because you can't fund yourself with deposits, like this one institution doing credit card deals out of the Midwest, whose name I won't mention.
Right.
Or, and if you get a capital bang on the backside, what are you really doing it for? You're getting the capital benefit somewhat, but at the same time you're getting cheap funding, which is why, in my view, it is not necessarily an arbitrage. But I'd say that there was, clearly people have arbitrage the capital, choosing securitization with the primary use of it is funding, and that's, I think, really the case today. I'm not saying they don't get it, particularly under Basel II, when you start skinning down the difference between the economic capital banks are looking at holding
right.
versus the capital charge that we charge regulatorily.
Can we talk about credit cards? I mean, do you think...
Everyone.
Yeah. Credit cards, in fact, I guess sort of that dance between the rating agencies and the banks, and I guess the regulators are kind of on the side.
What are you referring to, the dance?
Structuring the credit card deals. The back and forth. How much AAA can I get?
Yeah.
And then we issued implicit recourse, and then in our examinations, watch for it. And they found it in certain cases. In fact, in the crisis when, the master trust didn't perform, the rating agencies pushed, and the banks all supported the trust, except one.
If you recall, it was 96, we started looking at recourse rules. There was a discussion about holding credit cards on balance sheet, effectively for risk-based capital, because they have all the risk. And I think I reiterated it in something I wrote in 98. I can't remember the dates of the NPRs, the recourse rule. We knew that they had all the risk, and from a capital perspective, they should hold more capital. Yeah. And now the accountants have caught up.
In 2006, complex structured transactions guidance.
Is that with the SEC?
Yeah, it was with the SEC.
You didn't work on it.
Okay.
All right. That was credit risk group.
Okay. It just seemed like one last chance to. Anyway. Tom, there are other things that. May have been, but I'll just ask. There were other guidance issued, and some of it had a capital impact, like the subprime guidance.
2004?
There was a bunch of it. There was one in 1999, one in 2000, mm-hmm. and then we started issuing non-traditional mortgage. Were you involved with...
Tangentially, just, I know what was going on.
It could have a capital impact.
There was one piece where... There was some backlash from Congress about, if I recall, about trying to define subprime.
Yeah. And you were involved in that?
Just watching from the sidelines.
Okay.
I think that was the credit risk area as well.
Yeah. We've got some discussions there as well, so... In terms of your experience in various capital rules, all I guess public you can really read about is in the AMPRs and NPRs, the comments by the industry. I mean, that's public stuff. You can mm-hmm. see that. Behind the scenes, and again, this big banks thing, Were there areas that you felt, you know, maybe in hindsight that, you know, the big banks pushed too far?
Are you asking, you can see when the in the preamble for the final rule from the NPR, you can see what changes have been made.
That's right.
Because we say so.
Yeah.
And we say why.
That's right.
And we talk about the comments and we lay them out. And then we say whether we agree or we don't agree and why.
Yes.
Right. Now, you're basically asking me, I think, but why don't you actually refine your question before I answer it?
Said, for instance, in 2004, the initial capital charge on the liquidity component was suggested at 20%. The industry didn't like that, so I don't know, but it ended up being 10%.
Credit conversion factor on the liquidity facility, which
yes.
resulted from 160 basis points down to 80. No, actually, I think you got to be careful because a lot of times what happens in rulemaking, as you know, is that you go out more conservative typically because you know you're going to get some pushback, one. Two, really what you're going to do is if you go out more stringent, you're going to elicit more comments and you're going to get more feedback and you're going to get more input from the institution. So when you go out with a lot of these proposals, you're actually really soliciting information. And so the banks will come to you and talk to you, and they will provide their comments. Sometimes they will come and present data.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to make a judgment call as to whether or not you believe the information that you've gotten, and you'll try and verify it using third-party sources. You know, you've been involved in this.
Yeah.
And then if you're convinced that their case has merit, then you make an adjustment. I can tell you, the first thing that we do as regulators, you always go out with a much more stringent proposal.
That's a good point.
Because the more stringent the proposal, the more likely you're going to get feedback. So now in that particular instance, you look at what are they holding internally vis-a-vis their economic capital charge against the liquidity facilities. Right?
Right.
You go to the institutions and you do reviews at the mall. You ask the examiners at the bank to take a look at what's their experience been. And then you compare it with what you're being told and then you compare it with what you proposed.
Yep. In the guidance, the alignment with economic capital and the alignment of risk is, you know, various guidance is specifically mentioned. You can throw this question to the... But do you think the examiner... I mean, was that done? You know, and
I can't answer that question because, you know, you're asking me to basically opine on the quality of examiners in all the reserve banks.
Yeah,
some were good.
Yeah,
right.
Maybe, you know, we channel that question specifically about a particular topic or something.
I mean, you know, I'm in the policy area, so, you know, I do talk to people in the examination area and I do talk to people in the field. But, you know, I can't really answer.
Yeah.
What I think you're trying to get at.
Yeah. I mean, a part of this is, all of the guides that we have emphasizes need for strong risk management policies and procedures, various emphases, complete examiner understanding of the transactions. These are complex transactions, et cetera. I mean, that's just a constant theme throughout here.
Well, when you were examining credit card transactions at that one large bank down there in Virginia, you had a pretty good idea what was going on, and that was because that's what they did.
Yeah. Credit cards were easy. Yeah. Were there any other... I've asked about implicit recourse, which is right here. We've seen that. Maybe a little bit more on the 2001 recourse rule. I mean, there's a lot of comment all over the place. You've talked about it. It's meant to align risk.
Maybe it was to align capital with risk. You know, prior... Again, you look at the capital rules and the evolution with respect to loan sales and structured finance and all that. And,
participations. Mm-hmm. Securitization is nothing more than a fancy loan participation on a pool basis as opposed to an individual loan basis. So how do you hold capital against them? Before, we used to not have any, we used to give no benefit at all if a bank sold an asset.
That's right.
Any recourse whatsoever. Right? So what's the incentive on the on part of the bank? If we're not going to give them any break on the capital charge, the incentive is not to limit their risk on the asset that they sell, but to hold all of the risk on the asset that they sell.
Yep.
Because if they can hold 100% recourse, they get a better price when they sell the asset. Right? So give them no capital break. Capital is the same. If they sell the asset, they're going to keep all the risk and be exposed for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Things changed in the mid-90s. You know, basically Fannie and Freddie always had a break under our capital rules. As you know, that was based on the call reports. Facilitate the development of a secondary mortgage market on a nationwide basis. They were doing just fine until CRA and all that sort of stuff came into play. Possibly they were getting into subprime. Mid-90s changed the rules to incent banks to hold less capital, right?
That's right.
The low-level recourse, I think, was 95. And so basically at that point, we limited capital to the maximum amount of contractual loss that they had on the deal.
That's right.
On a loan set.
That's right.
And then the securitization rules were just an extension of that. I mean, because that's where, you know, when people started securitizing more and more to fund themselves, then there was, well, what about, you know, we sell everything and we hold this or we hold that, you know, what do we want to do for it? Thing is also you got to remember, what we did in 95 essentially was starting to hold capital 100% against the riskier bits.
Yep.
Because, you know, before that, everything was risk-weighted the same, the good stuff and the bad stuff. The good stuff should get less and the bad stuff should get more. And that's essentially what we did in the securitization, was adopt the first loss pieces, which is what we needed to do. That's what we should be doing, and that's what we did do. And that's what I mean by aligning the capital with the risks.
Where in this originate to distribute, which is one, on the website it's public, the 20 or so things the commission is charged with, the staffers are charged with looking at. One is the originate to distribute model and the role of securitization. Where did that go wrong as a policymaker? Where did securitization's contribution to the financial crisis?
It was underwriting. It wasn't securitization. Securitization is a tool. It's like a computer, garbage in, garbage out. So, I mean, people beating up on the credit rating agencies because they came up with their model or their estimation of the risk in the subprime was wrong, in large part because of no docs, low docs, fraud, and everything else that contributed to that. You could talk about the fact that the compensation schemes of some of these organizations that were involved in the originate to distribute, i.e., it's the mortgage brokers and the investment banks, were based on volume and not on performance of the assets, past or future, right? So securitization is a tool, and you can use the tool badly, and they did. But that doesn't mean, if you look at what happened in the securitization market, is primarily subprime mortgages and CDO squares that had difficulty. You can count the CIS if you want, but it was really the CDO squares, because they were backed by the mezzanines of the subprime mortgages, you know, and their deals, and they were thin slices, which meant that the LG loss given default was much higher when they did go bad, and that the correlation amongst those assets rose near close to one, right?
Right.
So autos are doing fine, much lower level than where they were in 2006, but they've not had an issue, right?
Right.
They're about half of where it was in 2006. Credit cards are having issues because people are deleveraging. They're also having issues because they have to consolidate. Right. So, what else do we got? Autos, fine, cards, private residential mortgages have not come back yet.
Right.
But you're doing deals through the GSEs because of the government guarantee. So, when folks talk about the originate to distribute, again, what they should be talking about is they should be looking at the underwriting standards. And that was bad, and the estimation of risk was off with respect to subprime mortgages by the rating agencies. And frankly, I think part of that is that, and it's my view only, is typically when people look at folks or a pool of mortgages, people always think that you're going to pay your house off first. You don't want to lose your house. That didn't happen with subprime mortgage borrowers. They paid the car, they paid the credit card because they needed the cash flow for the credit card and they needed to get to work and they needed their car. They were renters.
Also, there was a bankruptcy that changed their ability to get out of those debts, too.
With respect to credit cards, they were having that issue. But the thing is they still need the credit card to float their monthly bills. And I think that, when did that come? That came later, didn't it?
That was 2004. Filed with the credit card. It was sort of the bankruptcy provision that was about half the population or so.
But if you're going to default on a loan, you got a credit card and you got a mortgage. You know, they can still get out of the card. Just they just go bad. They just don't pay it. Right? You have a choice. I would pay my mortgage first. Other people didn't make that choice because they valued it differently. So I think that was probably a contributing factor as to why maybe the estimation of risk in those particular pools was bad. Not again, considering the fraud, the fact that a lot of people reporting they had jobs they didn't. Several people had several mortgages.
Yep.
When they couldn't afford one.
Well, 2001 we had already allowed these ratings, but specifically brought in capital charges by ratings. Did the policy area have any concerns, so your involvement with these ratings or the rating agencies' processes, were there, prior to the financial crisis?
Sure. Yeah, and that was all debated as to whether or not we should consider allowing the ratings to be used. People have looked at rating agencies. We knew the shortcoming. We knew it wasn't. The ratings were used because it's a market-based indicator of creditworthiness. And it's a way to do it in a granular manner, to come up with a gradation of risk. Is it perfect? No. We knew it wouldn't be perfect, but nothing is perfect. We also knew that from a capital perspective, if we wanted to move into Basel II, essentially another barrier to that, but the only big banks were really capable of doing it, even there.
That's right.
There are difficulties. So,
can we talk about Basel II and maybe any lessons learned or concerns that came out of Basel II and you've been there, been to Basel. So. And again, this is framed in terms of your experience, policy perspective. But were there lessons learned coming out of the implementation of Basel as we went in, the issues, data issues that came out that maybe would have caused concerns with some of these frameworks or the ability of the firms to be able to model some of the risks as the Basel II framework, even under Pillar 1 would require.
Be more specific.
Yeah. The management of their conduit programs, the management of their securitization programs, the granularity of their data. There could be positive and negative examples.
with my personal view with respect to the multicellular conduits is that I had no, I'm not particularly worried about that. In the exams I've done, the horizontal review I did back in the early 2000s, I was impressed then. I was, you know, still impressed with the management of those particular aspects. Now, with respect to other bits of the securitization, I mean, you know, I think everyone heard Chuck Prince's, you know, bit, so I'll just leave it at that.
It was good till it won.
Do the multi-sellers also have the same triggers to unwind if the assets lose a certain amount of value based on a fair value mark-to-market?
Well, while some of them may have held securities, most of them were holding loans. So there's not the same sort of market value information.
So they don't have the triggers?
No, they'll have, for instance, if delinquencies increase to a certain point, then they'll have a lockbox arrangement where they have to put the cash that they receive into this lockbox, and they can't commingle. The company can't commingle it with other monies that they receive, just to segregate out the money that's owed to the conduit. There might be a trigger based on credit rating if the company was rated. Many of them were not. So in other words, if a company were downgraded to BBB, then again the lockbox arrangement could kick in, and they might require over collateralization, they might have a lower advance rate. So they can do those sorts of things. Typically, in the conduits, they do an annual credit review to determine whether or not they want to keep doing business with this company and on the same terms, or do they want to change it. And the thing is these things are more actively managed, and I can say that they're
more
actively managed.
Sounds like also the triggers are designed to more strengthen the conduit as an ongoing entity, whereas in the single cell sieves, they're designed more to quickly unwind before losses got larger. So there's sort of a different direction in the target of the trigger.
A sieve, sieve is not a single cell program. A sieve is a variant of the credit arbitrage program. It's basically arbitraging the yield you're getting in on the assets versus the yield that you're paying off to the commercial paper investors. And the difference is that, again, the sieves do not have 100% liquidity backstop. As for the reason you were saying that the point is to unwind the assets to create the liquidity at the time that they need it, right? So that's why, you know, the rating agencies in the industry, you know, worked to come up with ways to create liquidity, which, as we talked about earlier, is expensive. There's other ways that people have talked about it in the past that didn't really fly, extendable commercial paper, whatever. But for the sieves, it was an arbitrage vehicle, arbitrage the difference in rates, and it was a structure that did not have full liquidity backstop. And market value triggers embedded in that structure were meant to create the liquidity by selling the assets when something was downgraded to, I think it was single A is typically what it was.
First, one other feature of the 2004 near historical was the eligible and ineligible program, which in hindsight seems a little bizarre. You know, assets 90 days past due or something, in that, you know, some of the securities would have had assets that were 90 days past due as a normal course. That was one of the comments at the time, that credit card programs. So you couldn't fund those assets directly, but you had securities in the programs that had those sort of embedded. But kind of a background on ineligible and eligible programs, there's a cliff effect if you're one or the other. And would you have designed that differently?
Were they a problem?
We don't know, because there weren't any ineligible programs. It sought, though, to...
The idea behind an eligible liquidity facility was to ensure that they weren't taking credit losses on the liquidity facility at the time that they draw. That was the whole point. So, in other words, to try and distinguish it more from a credit guarantee than it already had been.
Okay.
Right. So, we already have first loss in front, and what we're doing was putting in... codifying, for if you will, additional requirements to ensure that when this was drawn, the bank was not going to take loss today. You know, once they took responsibility for the assets, they would then have exposure after that. But we didn't want them to take loss today at the time of law. Question.
Steve, I got started a little bit late. I had some scheduling issues, so I just wanted to say sort of announcement that we're coming close to the station at some point in time, and if you want to
get
the important stuff still in.
Yeah. Some other regulators have thrown the Fed under the bus. No, that's not the way I say that. No, I want to talk about trust preferred securities, which were ultimately securitized in terms of CDO TRUPS. And in hindsight, you know, a lot of criticism.
Hindsight's great.
Can you talk about TPS and
what, again, more specifically, what are you looking for?
Maybe a quick, you know, background. I think it was 97. And was the Fed ever concerned? I mean, I know there were the capital rules were rewritten. The limit for internationally active banks was lowered. What were those concerns around in terms of trust preferred securities?
The limit for internationally active banks.
The 25% limit within the Tier 1 capital block was subsequent to the original.
Was lower.
That was
15.
Lowered. Yeah.
That was just recently. That was done.
But there was discussion.
Yeah.
What was the board's concern?
I think, you know, again, that's something you ought to talk with the people involved in that. If I recall, and I can't give you all the ins and outs, but think about it. I mean, lowering the 25% down to 15 is to strengthen the capital base.
Yes.
Right? So you can have more confidence.
That's right.
So, you know, basically, in the bank holding company rules, you were allowed cumulative preferred, non-cumulative preferred,
yes,
and trust preferred, and what they call internationally a hybrid. And then you had that 25% bucket, right?
Yep.
So that was squeezed down to 15. And minority interest was very specific. What kind of minority interest was that? That's essentially the trust. So the idea was to strengthen the capital base.
Yeah.
Which happened. I mean, many of the big banks had 85% common equity as the composition of their capital structure before the crisis.
Many of the big banks. This issue, though, the story here is the small banks.
Yeah, that's this. If you asked about
the history, I know. That's
big
true.
Banks are the ones that are really constrained by the 25 to 15%, not the small banks.
The other element is the securities that were created.
It's a different issue.
Yeah. I mean, the history there with the CDO TRUPS. I mean, the motivation, the industry came to us. I can remember the arguments at the time. I mean,
small banks wanted access to capital markets.
Exactly.
Small banks can't access the capital markets because they're not rated.
As the expert, what were some of the other arguments that were put forth by the industry to securitize and put together a whole bunch of the small banks?
Again, it's a funding issue, so the idea is, you know, do you want to allow them access to capital? It really is access to the capital markets. It's a funding issue. If you're a community bank or a smaller bank and you don't have...
I should be specific. It's the holding companies, too, that were involved in that.
But the holding companies and the small institution tend to be...
Just shells. Yeah. Basel 1A, and then the subsequent standardized. Again, kind of a small bank, large bank competitive issue.
Basel 1A, we didn't
never do it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the idea was more risk sensitivity, and including for mortgages. Some history around, in hindsight, would it have been a good thing? Who was pushing back on it?
Would it have helped in the crisis? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, there are some commenters who noted that there would have been higher capital charges for mortgages, particularly high LTV, based on the proposed measures.
right, the mortgages that they are suggesting that were a problem should have had an 8% capital charge already. Yeah. When you have a 3% down payment, that's the rule. Right?
Well, it says prudent.
3% is not prudent. Right? Prudent was always considered to be.
But it's an industry standard at this point.
Well, then I can tell you, banks I didn't chat with, examiners I chat with, 3% was not considered prudent. 3% down payment was not considered. 97% LTV was not considered. Capital charge on those eight. Now, if you're saying that banks were playing games with the capitals, you know that's always a possibility.
Yeah.
That's why we have examiners.
That's fair.
So, would, to be frank, you're asking me, if the capital went from 8% to 10%, would it have solved the subprime crisis problem? No. That's a ludicrous suggestion. It's an idiotic suggestion. Now put that in your wall.
It's in there.
All right. I disagree with the notion that an increase of a marginal increase in capital would have significantly mitigated the subprime crisis.
Tom, is there anything else, and we're winding down, that you think in terms of the capital rules? We'll obviously pick up on the VAR issue, but we've kind of done a securitization, ABCP. You've given us some real good kind of behind the scenes. And anything else that we ought to think about in considering the role of capital rules and either intended or unintended consequences of the financial crisis?
I think if you focus too much on the capital rules, you're going to miss the picture, which is underwriting, to be frank. It always goes back to the basics.
But getting past just the subprime debt and the way things move through the rest of the financial system, and really turn it into from just subprime losses to a financial crisis. You've got some of those spreading effects include entities such as AIG, which seems to have existed to some extent to facilitate capital arbitrage through the use of credit bureaus. It's not by American banks, but European banks. And I want to make sure I understand that correctly.
First of all, securitization, one of the goals of securitization is to transfer credit risk. Mm-hmm. It did. It worked. That's what it was supposed to do. You transfer the risk of the underlying assets to the investors. Now, you can take issue with the rating cars on subprime.
Right.
Now, with respect to AIG, they were involved in providing credit derivatives to many folks. But the capital rules for banks were able to use, in other words, for Basel II, AIG would have been an eligible guarantor. U.S., Basel II was not in effect. It's still just coming into effect now. So, but in Europe, it was in effect. The thing is you could have had the same issue with a bank prior to the financial crisis. In other words, prior. So AIG basically mismanaged the risk and concentrated the risk.
Yep.
And that's not a result of the capitals. They were trying to get the businesses like the Japanese and Swiss banks back in the early 90s. They did the same thing with credit derivatives.
We're just trying to understand.
Standby letters of credit.
We're just trying to understand the motivation for why the banks were so eager to buy credit protection from AIG. And I understand it was to it would lower their capital requirements. For this, I'm thinking of the European banks now who bought. These were, I think, mostly single name corporate credit risk protections that are buying from AIG.
It could be.
My understanding is that was to lower their capital charges under their adoption of Basel II.
There's many reasons.
For his opinion of why the banks did what they did.
Yes, I'm trying to understand the motivation for why there was such a large volume of business by European banks on single name CDS with AIG. As I thought it was to do with trying to lower their capital charges under Basel II.
Well, clearly I can't speak to the motivations of all these banks. However, one thing to consider is that you have internal limits on companies. the banks, particularly when they're big clients, have internal limits. So it's not just capital. It's they're hedging their exposure to the cable industry. It's hedging their exposure to a particular counterparty. So there's a number of reasons why they might have done it.
That's right.
So I think you have to be careful in suggest going right to capital. I mean, it's the easy thing to do. A lot of people like to do it, and particularly, frankly, with headline risk or headline desire to have headlines, this is where people go. But there's a number of risk management reasons why a bank would like to buy credit protection on exposure they have, is to limit their exposure. Now, the thing, you know, what was not necessarily considered potentially by some of these institutions was the degree to which AIG was concentrated and then their capability to perform. But AIG is one of the largest companies in the world, financially stable.
Well rated.
Well, I don't know.
Well rated, but did financially it stable. Lower their, would it have lowered their capital charges by buying credit protection?
Depend on what they bought and what. In other words, if they bought it, if they bought, for example, if they bought 100% credit derivative, if they bought a credit derivative of $25 million on a name, say on whoever they're exposed to, then it would lower their capital from potentially. Under Basel II. It depends upon, is it standardized? Is it IRB? Mm-hmm. And that's another thing you got to look at, because under IRB, if the company itself is financially a strong company and the exposure you have is senior and it's collateralized and whatever,
right.
The capital charge under the Basel II IRB in Europe, which was implemented at the time, could have been very low. And the capital charge, the capital benefit that they may have gained might have been minimal. Standardized, you could have more of an issue because it could be 100% risk weight and you could go to 20 under the Basel II standardized. But you're talking a lot of the big banks are the ones that where the contagion is. So
right.
Frankly, I think the capital benefit was probably more, was less significant than people would like to think it is. I'm saying that there wasn't one, that it might not be as big of an issue.
But we'll talk to the Barbie. Because their value in the derivative through to see how prevalent that was.
You'll have to talk to them about that. But I mean, just straight notion, just looking at it, okay, in the banking book, it's not necessarily. You'll have to talk to them about that. But there are other reasons other than capital.
That's right.
Okay?
And coming from a capital expert, that's the.
It's just my view.
You're not the only one who said look at underwriting.
Because that's what it is.
Yes.
Can we do one little quick piece of cleanup, which we did at the beginning, which is your CV. Can you summarize your background, your career trajectory?
Starting just at the Fed or before that? I've been at the Fed since 1984. I was in research 3 years and then transferred to banking supervision policy area in 1987. I've worked on structured finance since approximately 1988. Basel capital rules, international and domestic capital rules since that time. Had some input into accounting as well. Worked on a number of different policy issues that come up over the years. Clearly, you know, legislative initiatives have to be put into regulation, dealt with those. Spent 3 years in Basel at the BIS, working for the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, and now I'm back.
And you've been back since what month?
April 1st. Exactly.
What were you doing before 84?
Before 84? 84, you think. National Credit Union Administration for 1 year, small consulting firm for a second year, IRS Statistics Division for a third year, and prior to 81, I was in graduate school.
Where was that?
All right, you want my degrees? I've got a bachelor's in economics from Livingston College and Rutgers University. Master's in Applied Economics from SUNY Binghamton and an MBA in Finance from GW.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.